large gastropods. These are snails, gastropods, and the large ones tend to be predatory. And again, there are these kind of explanations, these kind of descriptions in the prose of Steinbeck and Ricketts that let you know that there were huge numbers of these big conchs here. The beach was beautiful with the pink and white shells of the murex. Sparky, who was a crew member, found them so beautiful he collected a washtub full of them. He, in fact, collected several washtubs full of them and would give them back to all his fisherman friends in Monterey when he got back. And we can look at those descriptions and also where they saw these large snails and where we saw them. So I've kind of counted up dividing these snails by their size classes. So there's three species that are really large, like these murexes, that are very large and decorative. And there's about five of kind of smaller, medium-sized species. And there's one species that's really small, just a few millimeters, maybe a centimeter long. And what you see is that in the smallest species, we saw that small species almost everywhere at 10 of the 12 sites that we could compare. But for the group of large species, it was really Steinbeck and Ricketts saw that those large species, we never saw them at any of the sites where they saw them. And the medium species are about even in terms of where we saw them. So what we're seeing is a shift towards the smaller species and a loss of all the large predatory snails out of there. And one thing that goes on a lot in every coastline around the world is a lot of foraging in the intertidal, that is in the tide pool zone, where it's easy to walk out at low tide and pick up what you want. And there's been a long, long history, as long as pretty much the history of humankind, of people going down into the tide pools and collecting things, and they tend to collect the biggest things because that gives you the most protein for your effort. And so these larger snails get wiped out of the tide pools, and then people have to move further and further offshore to get them, and what's left in the tide pools is the real smallest ones. An interesting side note to this is that if you go down now to La Paz in the southern Baja California Peninsula, normally you would see these beautiful murex shells in the gift shops there being sold, and you still see some of those. But the other thing you see are these starfish, it's called Pisaster. That starfish gets dried out and shaped into like elephants and little animals and stuff, and you'll see those in those gift shops here, but they don't live anywhere near there. The farthest south those starfish come down is northern Baja California. And what's going on, and I've seen this firsthand, is people are just going up here now, taking them by the sackful, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds at a time. You just pull them up with a stick and put them in a sack, and they get a few pesos a piece for them, and they're being shipped all the way down here to be sold as curios in the gift shop. So it's the kind of the idea is that these are less available now because they've been fished out everywhere. So you have something else filling in for this gift trade, something from the sea you can buy in La Paz, even though it came from nowhere near La Paz. These tube snails are an interesting lot. They are actual snails that build a tube and cement themselves to the rocks and sometimes form these big reefs of tubes, so they never move around as adults. Steinbeck and Ricketts really don't mention them much at all, although by 1960, this woman, Myra Keene, who studied them for much of her work, noticed them everywhere, and we noticed them everywhere when we went down there. Big bands on the rocks everywhere, these reefs of these funny little tube snails. Here again, there's a couple potential explanations. One is an ecological explanation, that is, when you lose these big predatory snails that would normally go and possibly drill through the tubes and eat the animals here, those things can now grow up because there's nothing eating them. That's a potential explanation. The other thing is that most of these things are subtropical and tropical species, and they may be moving north into the Gulf as the climate warms. This is a species from Central California that I studied at the Hopkins Marine Station that has become much more abundant in Central California due to climate warming, we think. So that same thing may be going on with the species down in the Sea of Cortez. And then these pelagic species, these free-swimming species, again, you have dozens and dozens of these kind of descriptions where they say, we could see the splashing of great schools of tuna where they beat the water to spray in their millions. The swordfish in great numbers jumped and played all about us. Great numbers of manta rays, they were monsters, sometimes 12 feet between the wingtips. All these descriptions over and over again. Now we were on the water as long as they were in the same time of year, and we just never saw any of that. We never saw swordfish jumping. We never saw schools of tuna. The manta rays, we never saw the big manta rays. We saw their cousins, which are called mobula. They look like manta rays, but they're much smaller. So again, we're seeing the smaller fish, and we're not seeing the big sharks, the big swordfish, billfish, and that kind of thing. We just don't see them anymore. They're still there, but you just don't see them in those kind of numbers. And here, I think the explanation is fairly straightforward, because we're seeing it throughout the world's oceans. Large pelagic predators like sharks and billfish being taken out, just cleaned out of the sea wholesale. And we see that all over the world. Even Steinbeck and Ricketts got a hint of what was going on with fishing, because they boarded a Japanese shrimp trawler late in their journey, and they saw this trawler trawl net grind along the bottom, pull up everything, not just shrimp, but all this what we call bycatch, everything that's caught in a shrimp net besides the shrimp. So here you see crabs and sea stars, you see some shrimp, but you also see skates and all kinds of fish. And they thought, wow, the sea bottom must have been scraped completely clean. And they worried about the ecological problems that this would cause. They said, it's not true that a species thus attacked comes back. The disturbed balance gives a new species ascendancy and destroys forever the old relationship. So here, fairly early on, they had these kind of ecological ideas that we often think of as kind of commonplace now. They were really thinking about the relationships of all these animals and what would happen if you really, you know, went through and destroyed habitat like they were doing with these trawl boats. One thing that's changed in sort of an opposite direction is this jumbo squid. It's called the Humboldt squid. Next to the giant squid, it's the biggest squid species. We know that Ricketts knew about this, because we can see from this photo from about 1936, he's holding a jumbo squid, which he had ordered from Southern California, where some had washed up on the beach. They don't often come up in California, but every once in a while they wash up on the beaches in large numbers. And when he heard about this, he ordered a bunch for his lab, because he thought he was curious about them, and obviously other people would be too. So there's that photo of him with that, but they never report any sightings of jumbo squid in their Sea of Cortez trip. But in fact, jumbo squid was one of the main reasons we were able to go down to the Sea of Cortez, because Bill Gilley, who I mentioned, the professor at Hopkins Marine Station, is a neurobiologist. Neurobiologists love squid because they have very big neurons that you can play with. And he got really interested because he heard that there were huge numbers in the last several years of these jumbo squid in the Sea of Cortez. And indeed there are all over the place, so that now it's one of the biggest fisheries in the Sea of Cortez. So this is the central Sea of Cortez or Gulf of California. And there's two areas where there are big fisheries for these squid. And this is Peru, but up here is Mexico. The catch of these squid from 1970 to the present, there were a few times where this fishery came in, but it's really since the 1990s that there's been big numbers of these squid. And again, you have a couple explanations. One is that climate warming may be helping these squid. The other is that the loss of all these other big predators due to fishing has allowed this big predator, these jumbo squid, to come in large numbers. And they're basically the top dog in the Sea of Cortez now.
What do you account for the huge variability in Peru with spikes and then goes down and fishery not bad?
Yeah, I think, you know, these kind of fisheries, and there's a few things going on. One is that they're relatively unregulated fishing, so sometimes you just get a massive overfishing and it crashes and comes back. But I think what these squid is, we really don't understand their population cycles at all. And you get some years where they just don't show up at all, and then some years where they're everywhere. A year or so ago, they were all the way up in Washington State. So there's still really a mystery what's going on with these squid. And like I said, there were reports of them going all the way back through the 20th century, them showing up at times in California. So these guys are real boom and bust, but what's interesting is that at least in Mexico, they've been able to sustain a fairly large fishery for a number of years now. This looks like 97, 98. This may be the big El Nino year that went through there, so that may have affected their populations there. So Steinbeck and Ricketts at one point said, we could not yet relate the microcosm of the Gulf with the macrocosm of the sea. Again, Ricketts always struggling to connect the small picture to the big picture. Now with the time difference that we've had between their journey and our more recent one, we can connect the microcosm of the sea to the microcosm of the Gulf to the macrocosm of the sea, because all of the things that we're seeing going on in the Sea of Cortez are happening throughout the world's oceans. We're seeing massive changes in coastal populations and coastal tourism and that kind of thing. We're seeing diseases, epizootic diseases, diseases that go through biological organisms all over the world, and those are increasing. We're seeing biodiversity loss everywhere, what I call fishing down the food webs. Now that was seen both in the large fish, where we don't see the large predators anymore, but also in things like the snails. So we don't have the large snails anymore, we're down to the real tiny, tiny ones. We're seeing the effects of both climate regimes, those are sort of multi-year periods of warm or cool weather, which I think affects those squid, and the overall effect of climate warming of the oceans. And this is something that I studied in Central California, but we see potentially the same kind of effects down in the Sea of Cortez. And what we have potentially, what happens with a lot of natural areas is this idea that's been called sliding baselines, that we go to a beautiful, beautiful place like the Sea of Cortez, and whether we went there in the 1700s or in the 1940s when Steinbeck and Ricketts went there, when they said it was a textbook exhibit for ecologists, or in the present day, where researchers still say the Gulf of California is a place of exceptional biodiversity, one of the few places in the world where marine megafauna still congregate. All of these statements are true at the time. This is a statement from the 1700s in the top, where an early explorer said, along the coast and adjacent islands are so many pearl beds that can be counted by the thousands. But the thing about it is, even though these are true statements for the time, they miss out all the changes that happened before. By the time Steinbeck and Ricketts got to the Sea of Cortez, all the pearl beds, those thousands of pearl beds, leagues and leagues of pearl beds, were all gone. They were wiped out by the pearl fishery. Likewise, the massive numbers of whales that these early explorers in the 1700s and 1800s saw, they're all gone, or largely gone by the time. There are still whales in the Sea of Cortez, but nothing like there used to be. And so the idea is, you've got to record what you see accurately in order to stop this idea of sliding baselines, where we lose our perspective on how much things have changed. So these same reporters, you see things where they are noticing ecological change. Even going back to 1632, from this explorer's diary, all one sees all around are heaps of pearl oysters along this coast, just empty mother-of-pearl shells to load many ships. So already they're seeing how much destruction has gone on. Steinbeck and Ricketts noted this massive bycatch. And these guys, Andreas Sanz Arroyo, a researcher down in Mexico, has a number of papers where they've interviewed fishermen. For example, on this little island in that photo, it's called Bartito, and it's an island where generations of fishermen have lived there for just on that tiny island. And what he notes, what they know, is that when they interview old fishermen, they will always say how much the fish has been depleted, how much farther they have to go to find fish, and that kind of thing. But when they interview middle-aged fishermen or young fishermen, they have no idea all these changes have occurred. So these are people who are living very close to the ocean, every day working on it, and yet the young people have no idea how different it used to be. It's only when you talk to the older people and record them, they would get things like, have the fishermen walk out how big fish they used to catch and compare those things. They would interview them, how far did you have to go? And those older people have the memory of what the Gulf used to be like. Now we rely on things like Steinbeck and Ricketts' records to understand what the Gulf used to be like. Is there hope for the Sea of Cortez and by extension for the entire ocean? I get a little hopeful when I met these guys who work as part of a fisheries cooperative. This is on the Pacific coast of Mexico, but there are similar things being set up. So this is the Sea of Cortez here, and along the Pacific coast where I did a lot of my graduate work, I learned about these cooperative fisheries. Each one of them has a symbol here, and each one of these fisheries, these fishing villages get exclusive access to a chunk of the sea in front of their fishing village, and they can pass that access down only to people within their co-op, and so they have an incentive to protect the resources in that co-op. It's co-managed with the government, so they get assistance from the government, but they do all kinds of things to protect their resources. The first thing they do that I noticed, because I would go out to this very remote area the middle of the night just to go count my snails and tide pools, and almost instantly I'd be surrounded by a truck full of guys with big, big guns. And that's how I learned about them, and they said, made sure I wasn't taking lobster or abalone, and then we got along great. So the first thing they do is they keep everyone else out from taking fish from their area. But they do all kinds of things that we think is very modern in fishing management. We have seasonal limits and limits on the sizes, limits on the gear you can use. They even have things within their own area. They set aside no-take reserves where no one's allowed to fish, so that those fish can replenish and seed the outside populations. Yeah.
So how far they can protect from the shore? I mean, how far?
These go out several miles. Most of their fishing is done by what's called ponga, which is a outboard boat with outboard motor, usually 40 horsepower, something like that. So they don't get out very far, several miles offshore. And most of the fish that you're talking about are nearshore fish, rockfish, octopus, lobster, abalone.
I asked that because in my country, in Colombia, and the Atlantic coast, you can protect it only very close to the shore. But over there, the people from United States and Japan come in and get all the fish, and
yeah,
it's so sad.
Yeah, well, this is a problem where you have the technology within these villages only to go off a few miles offshore, but like you say, boats from Japan can come clear across the Pacific and come in here. But at least in this shoreline area, they do a pretty good job of keeping everyone else. When you get out into either the 300-mile waters or the international waters, it's much more difficult, and they don't have much control over that. Another thing they do that's very interesting is they give seniority rights. So the oldest people in the village are the ones allowed to fish things like abalone, the things that get the highest value per effort. The oldest people in the village get exclusive rights to that thing. And then the next oldest people can fish the next most valuable species. And that seniority gets handed down. And they, as I mentioned, they have a strong enforcement ethic there. Their lobster most fisheries graphs that you see these days are usually bad news of a red line going down through time to almost nothing, but they've maintained a steady level of their lobster catch, for example. And for the lobster is the species that they've been certified by the Marine Stewardship Council. So this is a internationally recognized label that you can get if you meet certain criteria in your fishing. And you get this label as a certified fishery. And that lobster fishery in Mexico is the first Mexican fishery to be certified as a sustainable fishery. And I don't know, Dan, if you go to Weaver Street, I don't know if any of these labels show up on any of the fish that they sell there. But the basic idea of these labeling things, the potential benefits, is that for the fishing community, they can get access to new markets. For example, some of these high-end eco-tourism trips, I forget one of them that does sort of oceanic trips will only buy certified fish to serve to their clients. And that gives this fishing community a whole new market that another fishing community that isn't certified doesn't have, and usually a high-end market. So you see the same thing when you buy your organic produce. That label encourages you to maybe spend a little more to get what you assume to be a better product. The idea for consumers is so many people ask me, well, what can I do about fish? I like to eat fish, I like to eat seafood products, but I understand there's all this overfishing. Well, you can target things that have been certified and then at least have an idea that this was handled a little, the overall fishery is in a little better shape than others that don't have this label. And the real question is, does this actually benefit this whole process? Does it actually benefit the whole ecosystem? And that really depends on so many factors, like how solid is the certification process, and what do we really know about the ecosystem? And I would argue that despite the best intentions of these co-ops and stuff, we actually don't know a whole lot about the ecosystem-wide effects of their fishing. And part of that is because we have very little data on the other organisms that live in association with these lobsters and abalone and other things they're fishing.
Wait, what about fish farming? How does that affect food?
That's a whole other lecture on what fish farming does. Fish farming is highly variable, and it's going to be a topic that's going to come up a lot in this country as we try to figure out, do we need to regulate fish farming? What you see in some places in Mexico and other places is they're trying to farm species like tuna that need to swim thousands of miles. They're trying to put them in pens, and that's a very unsustainable way of fish farming because those kind of species, big top predators, need tons and tons of protein and nutrients. So you pour that into some offshore pen and a lot of the nutrients gets out and creates all kinds of problems. Some fish like catfish, which are fairly low on the food chain, are somewhat better for fish farming. One of the highest growth areas in fish farming is shrimp. And what you see in the South Pacific is tons and tons of mangrove habitat being converted to shrimp farms almost everywhere. Yeah. And so shrimp, you have, you know, both ways is pretty bad. You trawl them wild and you're digging up the whole sea bottom and taking all this bycatch. You farm them and you have this massive pollution problems, massive land use change problems. So aquaculture has potential to do a lot of good, but it has a long way to go. And most of the aquaculture is outside of the United States now, and it's relatively unregulated, and there's a lot of problems. So it's definitely not the answer yet. What I argue is that because of, you know, we don't have a lot of the information, we need to do a lot more natural history. And what you've seen just in the last few years is groups of scientists, these top two groups, PSCO and Marine, are groups that I've worked with on the Pacific Coast. The Census of Marine Life is working worldwide. The Long-Term Ecological Research Sites is a National Science Foundation program. All of these trying to just get more basic information at large, large scales of what's going on in our oceans. And this is important because we have a long history of natural historians noting ecological change in society. Going back, almost any society you can see, you can get evidence of the fact that they were aware of the natural environment and how it affected not just their ecology, but their society. Jared Diamond does a great job of talking about this in Collapse when he talks about Rapa Nui, Easter Island. John Muir, of course, was a great natural historian, but also was a recorder of ecological change and problems in society when he fought against damming the Hetch Hetchy so that San Francisco could have more water. But the interesting thing is all this past history still has a very narrow viewpoint, and it's best illustrated from this quote from John Muir, who said, well, at least we can't change the atmosphere. So less than 100 years ago, one of the greatest conservationists ever, John Muir, could not conceive that through our activities, although we could dam up Yosemite and ruin it, he couldn't conceive that we could actually change the atmosphere. And of course, all of that's changed. So both the reality has changed. Our atmosphere has been changed by our activities. Our oceans have been changed. We've been the vectors of all sorts of new diseases and loss of biodiversity. But our perception of that reality has changed quite a bit from these early natural historians like Darwin, who had to grind along on the Beagle for years and years and years to see everything he saw. With remote sensing now at the large scale and with microscopy at the very small scale, we can do natural history at everything from the molecular scale to the interplanetary scale. You're reading articles now about water on Mars, and I'm sure signs of life are sure to follow. Plus the advances of genetics and the computing, the ability to take huge, huge amounts of data that the natural world provides us with and tell a story with it. And so what I'm saying is that these changes, both the technological changes and the natural changes, have meant that natural history now, which for a long time in the 20th century was sort of a backwater of science, a thing that amateurs did, and real scientists didn't really mess with all of that, is now one of the most important activities we can do, these basic observations of nature.
What is that picture? What was that? Was that headlines?
Let me see. Let me pull this back. This is actually a study, I think a really neat study of, these are air travel routes. And so this was a study of how diseases might move, like if you had an outbreak of avian flu, all the vectors that, how instantly, I mean, this is like one day's air travel, go everywhere. So these guys were doing natural history at this big scale. How would a virus spread itself quickly around the world using the air travel routes? So what we can see is that now that we can do natural history at this big scale, we can do some really big things. So for example, back in the early 70s, Roland and Molina, two chemists who ultimately won the Nobel Prize for this work, illustrated how if chlorine got into the upper atmosphere by itself, it could catalytically destroy ozone, which they knew protected us from the UV radiation. Now, that was an important paper. Like I said, they ultimately won the Nobel Prize. But it wasn't really until we had the natural history of this, that is, the actual observations of an ozone hole. And this was natural history at a big scale, satellites giving us data that allowed us to see this massive thinning of the ozone layer over Antarctica that really sparked us into action, which led to, just a few years later, the Montreal Protocol. It's one of the most successful international environmental agreements to eliminate in time the use of chlorofluorocarbons, which were these chemicals that were ultimately destroying the ozone. So here's a case where you had a theory, but it was really the observations that catalyzed us into action. In this case, very positive action. And the question is, could the same thing come with the current debate on climate change, for example? And so I go back to Ricketts again, where he says, I got to thinking about the ecological method, the value of building whole pictures, again, building from small to big. No one can controvert it. It would undoubtedly be good if political leaders would get to know that method. And so where I sort of fit into this, I oscillate along this spiral between my work in the tide pools and much more political work. And what I'm doing now with this new institute at Duke University, the Nicholas Institute, it's part of the environmental school there, where we're really trying to connect science and research that's done in various fields, not just ecology, but law and economics and public policy, and connect it to the actual policy-making program. So that's why I spent a year of my life in D.C. working for Congress to sort of figure out how that process works. And now, again, I sort of bounce back and forth because I think we need to connect those two worlds, the natural world and the policy world, to make some of these changes. And so I'll just leave with this quote from Ricketts, who says, "It's advisable to look from the tide pool to the stars and back to the tide pool again." And I think that really summarizes his idea of the need to connect the very minute observations of nature and the big picture of how nature and human societies connect. And all of these people and many others were part of this expedition, groups that supported us. And I'm sad to say that the Gus D was scuttled recently when Frank was trying to deliver humanitarian aid after a hurricane in Baja California. So that was one of the last great journeys of the Gus D. Thank you.